Hear that? It's the sound of you catching up on all the latest and greatest fintech news, trends, and updates thanks to Streetworthy, Yield Street's bi-weekly newsletter. Stay in the know with CEO Milind Mahiri as he takes a closer look at what's happening in the fintech space, then breaks down what each story could mean for investors like you. Give your portfolio the edge it deserves and subscribe to Streetworthy on LinkedIn today.
Welcome to The Yield, the official podcast of Yield Street. Every week, we bring you the latest market insights across our asset classes and products from subject matter experts. Our aim is to break the outdated mold of investing and help you add financial fuel to your ambitions through innovative investing products and strategies typically unavailable to most investors. Realize your next level with The Yield. Subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. The views you are about to hear do not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street. This podcast is intended to be strictly informational and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a research report, investment advice, or the offer or sale of securities or any investment product. Now, let's get into the show.
Welcome, everyone, to another Yield Street webinar. It's the first time we're doing this out of our tech and product group here at Yield Street, so we're really very excited to take you on a little journey behind the scenes of how we build our platform. I'm Rishi Dixit, I'm the CTO here, and I'm joined by Sylvain Grand, who's our Chief Product Officer. Before we get started, just wanna kind of some information about Yield Street. Make sure you go to yieldstreet.com to learn more about our offerings across various asset classes and any market updates. And in general, there's a lot of useful information about what we do and our products. So we also have mobile apps for both iOS and Android. So welcome you to download these from Google Play or the App Store. And if you are an originator joining us today, definitely check out our Raise Capital page on the website or send an email to originations@yieldstreet.com. Well, we'll spend about half an hour or so just chatting, telling you a little bit about how we go about building our product, and then we'll leave about 10-ish minutes at the end to answer any questions. We're more than happy to. That said, Sylvain, you want to start off with an introduction of yourself?
Yeah, welcome everyone. It's quite exciting for us to do that, this webinar, and to have a chance to share a bit more stories about what we do, how we work. Super brief intro. I joined Yield Street roughly 8 months ago, and I've been an investor on the platform, actually, so a user for over 2.5 years. So happy to share also some of that experience. And I work very closely with Rishi and the team, and I particularly manage the product management, the design, and the data teams at Yield Street.
Thanks. And speaking about myself, I've been involved at Yield Street in some fashion pretty much from the very beginning. I met Milind who was our CEO back in late 2014, and I helped him build out the first version of the platform back in early 2015 before we launched. And I was an advisor for a couple of years before coming on board full time about 3.5 years ago in 2017. And just kind of as a compliment to what Sylvain manages in the company, essentially I'm responsible for all things engineering, which includes the product engineering, test engineering, and of course the infrastructure and IT setup of the company as well. I, like Sylvain, have been investing in Yield Street since myself as an investor for over 4 years now from some of our early offerings in 2016. So, which we always believe is a very important thing to do to taste your own soup, if you will. And here we are like five-ish years later, and we are building away, and there's a lot more left to build for us. So we're pretty excited to share a little bit of that as well. I'll spend a little bit of time giving a little context on how I got introduced to the company and the founders and what made me kind of like come on board. So as I mentioned earlier, Milind shared the first vision deck for Yield Street back when we didn't even have a name. That it was just an idea, like the classic NewCo pitch deck of an idea of building an alternative investments platform to bring the kind of opportunities that typically were reserved for large, you know, people who could write large checks in, you know, private equity firms or hedge funds. And as someone who was looking for diversification outside the market, having still recovering and hurting from 2008, it was a very attractive idea. And the most remarkable thing for me about that was 6 years on, virtually nothing in the pitch deck has changed. We're plugging or galloping at times along a roadmap that was set over 6 years ago. And as someone who's been in the startup world for well over two decades now, it's such a refreshing concept to have such amazing true north find right at the beginning. And of course, I was there in the baby phases, and now I'm kind of excited to be in this growing up phase of Yield Street as we go from adolescence to almost like our adulthood at this point. So every stage brings along its interesting challenges, and part of the scaling process is scaling the leadership team of the company in the right way and bringing in seasoned executives. And this is kind of where so that comes in, actually, in a very significant way.
I think that's maybe a good point to explain some of the product offerings and the product opportunities and challenges that we have to deal with from a product and tech executives. I think many of you may be familiar with Yield Street, what we do, but essentially, if you think from an investor standpoint and life cycle, what we have to deal with is obviously be able to provide clarity on what we do, the different products, asset classes, and other types of products, like the Yield Street Prism Fund that we launched earlier this year, to different set of investors that have different level of understanding around what it means to invest overall and to invest in alternative assets. Then there's obviously the typical journey of a new investor signing in, onboarding, and we have obviously we're a regulated business by the SEC, very strict requirements from a, know your customer, a verified accreditation. So every user on the platform has to have their accreditation status as defined by the law, verified by us on a yearly basis. Then we can finally, show offerings to the user. We can talk more about that, how we present offerings on the platform. And then once you invest, obviously you want to ensure that you have a good understanding of what's happening to your investments. So we go into like what we call the portfolio section of the user experience, where we both report, share any activity updates, and give you a sense of how your portfolio is doing, and it's particularly critical in our space because we deal with different durations, different risk profile, and as well as in general, we're operating on an illiquid space. And so you for instance, accrue interest on a daily basis, but you're paid on a monthly or quarterly basis, depending on when the coupon are there. And then you have essentially your first payment, your second payment, and your final payment. And then you may decide to reinvest in similar offerings or new offerings. So we have to manage all that life cycle. And so I think that's pretty important. And then just in terms of additional offerings, and I know some questions came in terms of we invested quite significantly around the ability to invest through an IRA. So you can open a Yield Street IRA. It's on yieldstreet.com/IRA that you can find all the details, including the fees. So we have a very simple fee structure depending on the portfolio size, the value size of the IRA money that you move to Yield Street. And it's like very clear fee. There's only one fee, no transaction fees, no exit fees, etc. So you can find all the details there. And then I talked briefly about the Yield Street Prism Fund as well, which is a different kind of offering because it's essentially a fund that invests across all of the asset classes that you're familiar with as a single investment. And this is important because in a way, as an investor, you can, have maybe a more passive experience and achieve a faster diversification than if you would invest on, usually our deals have 10K minimum. So we're looking at all these aspects around, how to provide always the right information to different set of users across different products that behave slightly differently. The fund being not having exactly the same payment schedule, it has quarterly distributions. So we have to deal with that. And then at the end of the cycle, which I forgot, is obviously things like statements, tax. So we have all these kind of milestones that are like visible to you as a user. And then Rishi can speak about like all the things that are less visible. We obviously support internal teams with internal systems. We have a lot of advanced security. We take that very, very seriously. So we can talk about that if there are questions as well.
This is a good segue into a couple of things that are critical. As Sylvain mentioned, for a regulated industry or company like ours or many others in our space, but also as a high growth mode startup. So their security obviously is a very critical thing. And there's a very, very, very good question that came in, which I'll answer very shortly. The question is about how we find the balance between user experience and security. And that's a great question. It's a challenge that we all work with or deal with on a daily basis. Let me start by saying it starts with a fun little battle between me and Sylvain, you know? So because I'm always going to go security and Sylvain's going to go experience, and we always find good middle ground. But in all seriousness, this is a very interesting area, not just for us, but for a lot of the ecosystem that around security that is built in the tech space. And by that I mean that, let's take some specific examples. One of the most critical things about security is just your front gate, logging into the system. Obviously, this is your data. It's very critical. It's private. It's personal. And we, like all platforms, regulated or otherwise, we provide an ability to do two-factor authentication. Now, that by its very nature is an added layer of friction on top of your basic simple username and password-based sign-in. So how do we handle the friction behind that? The companies, there are creative companies that are trying to reduce the friction in these highly essential operations. Part of it is just education, the importance, the cost-benefit analysis of like why it's okay to take a little bit of extra pain or friction to secure your data because the downside is so massive. And then we do everything we can to kind of keep on top of what are the advancements that are happening in a particular area of security that can prove to be a friction point for a user. So kind of to continue on this two-factor authentication example, right now we offer three ways of doing two-factor authentication. We can do it by SMS, which by the way is the least secure of the many secure two-factor authentication mechanisms. We offer voice, and we offer an app-based authentication mechanism. All of these have some level. You have to go away from the site to look at your phone or to pull up your two-factor app. And we are working on a feature that will automatically push a two-factor to your phone. So you don't have to do an extra step. You'll just have to, you know, the path is a little bit less rough or friction filled. This is a kind of an example of things that we're constantly exploring and trying to do to balance a user's smooth experience with security. But when in doubt, when it comes to a decision point, we will always, always err in favor of higher security, even if it means, and then it's up to us, and which we try to do as good a job as we can to educate the users about why it's okay to take a little bit of extra pain to get to a certain step. And we talked about a lot of the software we build for you guys, well, for most of you or our investors, but there is an equal, if not bigger amount of software that we also build out of our product and tech group that is for internal people, like that is for our investment operations group. These are the people who make sure you get paid on time. And our investor relations group who are our front gate, you know, for all the questions that you may have, complaints occasionally as well, of course. So all of the software that we build for these internal teams are built by the technology group. And this is one of the key ways to scale a system, because there's two kinds of scale that we start building for right from the get-go. I call it planning for your own success. One is obviously your product or the system you're building is so widely popular that everyone wants it. So you have a rapidly expanding user base, high traffic, and you need to architect for that. But the other, often not always equally talked about kind of scale, is operational scale. How do we handle tens of thousands of investors without having to scale our investment operations group to 100 people or 200 people? How can we make sure that a smaller, but you know, super smart, but very lean team can handle cash flows and fund flows of tens of millions of dollars across a large and growing investor base? This is made possible by the other kind of scale, which is operational scale, automating a lot of internal processes so that you don't need too many, because humans will always be one of the biggest impediments to scale. So I'm going to talk a little bit more if questions come in, but those are aside from building the products that we build for internal and external audiences, a lot of what my group, both at the architecture, we have a group called Platform Architecture, and then there's obviously an infrastructure group whose primary responsibility is to make sure that the platform is ready to take on an ever-increasing scale, both on the user side and just dollar side.
I think some of the topics that I think many of you may be interested in, and that is a general topic on product and tech, is how do we work and the idea of prioritization, right? We have, as any organization on the planet, limited resources. And most of our job is to provide clarity around what we need to be working on. And more importantly, to create the environment where people have the understanding around weighting priorities and discussing and debating some of these priorities. And I think, not surprisingly to you, with some of the topics that Rishi talked about, it's all about, you know, what's the return of it on investments? How much time, how much effort versus what's the value for you as investors for the company? And some of these things that Rishi talked about around security are, you know, very difficult to quantify because it's mostly a risk perspective that we're looking at. And so that also plays into the consideration of our prioritization view and roadmap, meaning if there is that event that might be once in a lifetime or once, you know, below 1%, but it's very high risk, obviously it is prioritized. And I think some of the internal questions that came in as well, you know, around also how do we handle security internally in relation to things like accreditation documents, is an example. Like internally, we also have restricted access persons and systems, whereby what is called the PI, the personal identifiable information of the user, has obviously huge restrictions in terms of who can access that internally. So, you know, accreditation, I'll answer two questions in once. The data is obviously extremely secure, and you have several ways to get verified. From an accreditation standpoint, you have the income-based, you know, verification methods based on W-2s and equivalent documents. You have the third-party letters where you can get essentially your accountant or any other authorized person to, you know, verify it for you and then just send that authorized letter to us. Or, you know, the non-income overall kind of value of your estate or portfolio, et cetera. And then you have a lot more documents to provide. So these are the three official methods that we provide. You can find a lot of details in our FAQs. But this is something that, you know, we need is added thinking for us. And we treat that internally. We don't outsource those as well. That's another question, I think, that came in. But I think it's all about the decision around what creates value for you as a user, what creates obviously engagement, what do we need to do to support new offerings. An example, I think some of you may be familiar with the Yale Street Prison Fund that we launched earlier this year. And I talked about it's obviously a slightly different setup. It is a 48-month fund originally, now a bit shorter duration as we launched it in February, with a quarterly distribution. So it operates slightly differently. It has, you know, external parties that support some of it, including valuation of assets. And you can find a lot of details on YieldStreetPrismFund.com. I think one question that came in was around the kind of the return on of the Yield Street Prism Fund. So 7% is a quarterly distribution, is a distribution on an annual basis value, but done quarterly. And you'll find the details on the return of invested assets currently, which is 9.18%, but more details on YieldStreetPrismFund.com. But we have to deal with all these details, and you understand that we're in a business, and I'm sure you appreciate that, is as investors, where we also cannot make mistakes. Numbers need to be, you know, validated, auditable, and trustworthy at all times. So this is very important in terms of how we approach as well product development and engineering processes. You know, software companies are known to, we work, if you're familiar with that, in an agile environment where we release frequently. You know, part of that is to take an iterative approach and always push out improvements. But we have the added, I think, point as a fintech company that we're dealing with very important information and very critical information, which is essentially your investment, your money. and we cannot afford to make mistakes. So that's something for people who are more familiar with product and tech. That is, I think, an added spin to the vertical we operate in.
There are some like very good questions coming in that actually are good segues into some of the things. And we'll try to get to as many of the questions as possible, of course, in the time we have. But one of the questions is about our teams themselves, like how big are they? And it's, so collectively, what we call it internally, the PDT complex, which is basically product, data, design, and technology. And across all of those, we are at, what are we, 50-ish at this point, but it's about give or take 50 people across 4 different countries and 3 different continents, and of course that is probably not unique in that sense, because a lot of companies have certainly startups have in-house like local HQ based teams and then nearshore, far shore. But what I find really unique about our teams is, regardless of what office they're in and what general engagement structure they have with the company, they're all extremely active participants in the process. They are all our team. And as someone who's managed offshore teams across the globe for about 15, 16 years now in various capacities, this is a very refreshing cultural shift that has proved to be of great benefit to us as a company and to the engineers and the team themselves. We have engineers in Brazil, in Argentina, in Malta, and of course in our main office in New York. So managing a distributed and largely remote team like this is obviously, you know, requires a well-defined set of processes to make sure the communication flows properly and the time zones are managed properly. And I think while all the tools that are needed for this kind of communication, whether it's project management or communication, straight up communication like Slack, it is important to have a mindset that, you know, we are here, we will adjust based on our colleagues' times if they happen to be 6 hours ahead or 6 hours behind. And we've built, I believe, a very kind of harmonious and collaborative culture across all of these different teams that seem to really work really well together and kind of help each other in every way. And we get a good bit of more or less round the clock coverage of our platform, which is a nice little added benefit as opposed to an intention, which has been done in the past. So that's, we can talk a little bit more about the various tools that we use, but ultimately it's about defining and agreeing to and willingly participating in a process, and the tools just become an aid to assist that process around the other way around.
Absolutely, and I think obviously there are some questions also on how we use data analytics, etc. So maybe to talk about also the different groups that we briefly touch upon. The way we work really in terms of agile methodology on a what we call iteration and sprint basis, on a 2 week basis, and we try to release twice a week at a minimum cadence, and we have different teams that essentially work together across product design, engineering, and data to deliver a set of experiences around a particular area of the life cycle from an investor standpoint. So we have, for instance, a team that looks at onboard from the sign up to really onboarding you on the platform. We have a team that looks at the investment experience, how to make the information clear, the smooth process, collecting all the necessary information. And then we have a team that, for instance, look at the portfolio experience. And we have some other teams as well, but just trying to explain a bit how we work together. So the data team, for instance, I've seen a question on that, obviously contributes to many internal and external facing kind of processes and data points. Examples are some of the statistics on our home page or other pages obviously are kind of computed by internal teams and data team is involved. We just released recently eos3.com/statistics, which gives you on a quarterly basis quite a significant and very transparent way to look at some of the numbers that may matter to you as well. And we always try to, like to our earlier point, we both need to have reliable and trustworthy information, and a lot of the information as well is subject to either regulation or specific filing towards the SEC. So it's a very stringent process that maybe some of you as investors are not always familiar. A very concrete example is any updates to literally any words we use on the site, on the Yale Street Prism Fund, or any marketing material has to go through internal, legal, a compliance team, and sometimes external lawyers, and then has to be filed and edgarized, which is a specific process with the SEC. So I think this is quite important to state that it's not like, maybe some other companies in our space have different approaches and you know, there are different setups from a regulatory standpoint. We're a registered investment advisor, so we have to comply with very, very specific rules, and we take that extremely seriously. So I just wanted to state that because it obviously matters in terms of how we work as a team, the processes we have, and what we need to support as well. I've seen some questions around, you know, what kind of internal and external audits we go through. I mean, we have several audits as part of the space we operate under and we're regulated by. So that's really important. I think maybe one point around, I've talked a lot about Yale Street Prism Fund. We're very excited to announce, and that was one of the questions, that this is our first product that is opening to non-accredited investors. And the next offering will go live on August 17th, so next Monday. So I just wanted to clarify that as I've seen a question in the chat. Maybe Rishi, you want to, we can talk about briefly like some of the challenges around, you know, how to have an engaging user experience in relation to an illiquid asset and like just the philosophy we have in terms of transparency, access. Maybe we can talk about that for a few minutes.
Yeah, sure. I just wanted to kind of quickly touch upon one thing about the Prism Fund opening up to non-accredited audiences on Monday. I mentioned earlier about a virtually unchanged direction in True North, and there were two boxes on that initial deck, which had diversified funds and wider audiences. So this was something that was contemplated all the way back when. And it's kind of like another one of those refreshing examples for me as someone who's worked in startup that have pivoted for all the right reasons or sometimes not so right reasons to have this kind of a clear direction. So one of the key things about building user experiences, obviously, so there's two things from an experience standpoint, another one from an overall architecture standpoint that are kind of important for us to keep in mind. And it's one of the questions that came in about competitive advantage as well, which kind of relates to this. From an experiential standpoint, like because our primary product offering is something that is it's a little more complex than the typical products that you would see on many investment platforms where people fundamentally understand the idea of an exchange traded fund or a mutual fund or a straight up equity or stock. Because these are slightly more complex or sometimes fairly more complex products that are not only kind of tricky to describe in terms without that are digestible without being too verbose, while at the same time staying compliant based on our regulatory requirements, actually is where some of our design and product teams come in and kind of show what they kind of shine through. And it's a constantly improving iterative process where if you go to what we call the offering detail page, you go to our storefront, if you will, and you click on a particular offering and you see the detail. If I kind of track the journey of that, how that page looked down the years from the founding of Yale Street, it's been increasingly enriched with, it's kind of evolved from a very text heavy sort of page to more interactive, more videos, more graphics, and we're only just beginning. I'm positive that there will be several other subsequent reimaginings of that page to make it even more interactive, make it more digestible, make it more attractive, and just understandable overall. And on the back end of it, as True our mission, as we constantly look for different kinds of investment opportunities, different kinds of asset classes, different kinds of fund structures, or product structures overall, it is an interesting future-proofing problem, as we call it in tech, to design the architecture around it. So, by and pretty much about most of the actual software that underpins both the investor-facing side and the internal-facing side of our platform is largely agnostic to the actual asset class. It's built in a way, to the extent possible, it's not always 100% possible. It shouldn't be because we have that crystal ball and we don't know what next interesting asset class we may go into. The more we insulate the core functionality of the platform from the specificity of a particular asset class, the more future-proof your platform becomes. And that's kind of one of our biggest advantages. Like, there's a lot of alternative investments, good alternative investments, investment platforms out there. I invest in some of them too. But they're pinned to a particular asset class and they go deep, which is a great model for, you know, there's nothing wrong with it. But our competitive advantage or differentiator from day one has been the diversity of our asset classes and the fact that the platform is not specific or pinned or limited to a certain asset class. This not only gives us, and the platform was designed and built in a way to keep it agnostic to the asset class so that we could in the future be able to relatively seamlessly go in different directions and create different products. Now, this is not always an easy technical problem to solve, and it certainly is a very fun one to solve, and we certainly had a lot of fun solving for it. I think a couple of kind of related questions that came in, which kind of pertain to this, is a very, very popular question or point of debate, again, between product and tech, is refactoring and how much time we set aside for refactoring. So the way this relates to building a platform that is relatively kind of generic and is you limit the need for a certain kind of refactoring. That said, building enterprise production level software is always a battle between time to market and beautiful, clean software design. You always never want to build the most beautiful software system. You want to build a system that hits a certain level of quality that you care about from a long-term extensibility and flexibility and scale and security standpoint. But if you're convinced that you've release the most beautiful piece of software out there, more than likely you're too late. So, which means that you're always going to incur little bits of debt. And that's okay, that's a good thing. And the way we handle that by and large, except for a few big epic tech dev projects that we've had in the last couple of years, is sometimes, yeah, there is a percentage per sprint that we say, okay, well, we have a little bit of bandwidth, let's clean up that little microservice and make it use the new framework or whatever. But really what we try to do is we try to do it in the context of something that we're building anyway. And we take, if it's, for example, a 3-point task to build something, we'll say, hey, can we take a couple of extra points, story points to do what needs to be done, but at the same time, fix this debt that's been sitting there for the last 3 months. And I'm going to be touching that same piece of code, might as well fix it then. And that's actually a very efficient process. Because to me, software tech debt is like credit card debt. You know, you have to pay it down on a regular rhythm. Otherwise, it just becomes something that's completely untenable. And it would take 6 months off to fix it. Hopefully, that answers that question.
That's, I think, a very important point. It goes back to the prioritization. Like high level, you always have to balance what in product and tech companies you outline as keeping the lights on, the tech debt part of it, and then new features or new experiences, right? And it's a balance. The tendency for sure is to always go and index favorably in favor of new features and new experiences, but you can never neglect keeping the lights on, making sure that the site runs for everybody, your infrastructure is there, the experience is safe and secure, all these things. So I think trying to answer a few questions that came in, you know, we can talk more about technology and cloud stack in general. We use, you know, cloud providers such as AWS. We have, you know, our website is in React, and our mobile application is actually React Native. And then, you know, Rishi can talk about the deeper stack, how we use Akka, etc. I don't know if we need to go into the details. Trying to like list all the questions that I think are coming. And thanks for asking all these questions. Allowing multiple contingent beneficiary instead of just one. It's a feature on the roadmap, but it's not in a very upcoming sprint. So just, bear with us. We wish we could be doing all these things next week, but we're not always able to achieve all the goals we set for ourselves. In terms of thinking about the balancing the focus on non-accredited investors and SEC compliance. I'm not sure I fully understand the angle of the question, but the Prism Fund was always set up to be available to non-accredited investors. And then we chose to launch it to our existing user base of accredited investors in the first place. But all the work from a regulatory standpoint, compliance standpoint, was done from the start to be available to all investors. So we're just essentially officially opening the gates, but all the processes, et cetera, have been set up for a while. I think to develop further some of the question and the answers from Rishi on competitive advantage of our platform, I think it's multiple fold, right? I think there are very, very few platforms that actually give access to the kind of products that are on Yale Street across the variety of asset classes and are supported by a scalable tech infrastructure. And what I mean by that, if you have invested on Yale Street, you essentially, invest and, unless see the portfolio, et cetera, unless you have a question, a specific issue, you would not interact with a human person. We're always there. We're available. There's, help, support, investments at yieldstreet.com. And on the website, you can see this help always present. But the full process, including, Rishi talked about supporting our operations team, all the structuring behind the loan book, everything is in a way, to a large extent, automated. And there are very few platforms, you'd be surprised, that have that level of automation and security built in, and definitely not across multiple asset classes. So that's really, really quite unique in our space.
On the same line, and we'll take a couple more questions because we are coming up on time, and I just wanted to spend a few minutes just talking about the future. But from a security audit and scanning, yes, we have several tools in our CI/CD tool chain that automatically scan, do code smell analysis and check for defects and things like that. That's just a part of our automated delivery pipeline. On top of that, we obviously do several annual audits on network penetration tests, infrastructure audits, and things like that. These are just things that on top of things that we are required to do as an RIA, we do all of these things just to keep our platform current and secure at all times. We're in the middle of SOC 2 audits and several other industry standard audits as we speak. So this is just a big part of what we do as a regulated company. As far as the internal systems, I think there's a question about do we integrate with external. I would say majority of the internal software is homegrown. It's built, it's bespoke to Yield Street because of the unique set of requirements that we set out to build the software platform with, the agnosticity of it and the scale of it. So we didn't want to rely on getting an off-the-shelf piece of software and then, tweaking it to make it do what we needed it to do. I think the last kind of point that I wanted to make on overall security is security is as a concept is never over. We are never satisfied. Of course, the platform is as tight as a drum as we can, but we never sit still when it comes to security. It's foremost in our minds at all times. So we're at we're almost at 45 after. So maybe
maybe a few. The question from Andrew Beaumont on do your internal operation teams work with the backend of the Yield Street platform? Yes.
Yes.
We actually, high level, do not use any backend investment management systems from that perspective. It's all built internally. The question from Mark, do we scan for security defects while developing as we go? Yes. Essentially, that's part of the processes. And we have a release process when we release usually on Tuesdays and Thursdays, for instance, insider information. So we have all these processes with automation and some obviously manual testing. We're all users, Rishi and I in particular of the platform. So we have a different set of processes to ensure that, to our earlier points, and the data is there.
And some of the things that we're building, we actually share. We started to share some of those on our new product and tech blog. It's called Distributed. It's a nice little wordplay that we tried to do. Distributed.yieldstreet.com. And as we build some of these interesting things, some of those we'll try to share on that blog if anyone's interested.
Our philosophy, I think, from a product management and design standpoint is to, we're here to provide access to unique opportunities that previously were only accessible to institutional investors. That comes with responsibility and, you know, transparency information. I think if you've used the platform for some time, you've seen that maybe you have feedback on that, hopefully positive, that we've really, really put a lot of effort into providing transparency with monthly updates on some of the deals, with much more clear perspective in your portfolio in terms of statements, overview, etc. A lot better parity between our website and the mobile app, because we know that many of you now use our mobile app to invest or check your portfolio on the go. So this is really, really important to us.
Right. I think we are at time. Thank you so much, everyone, for joining us. This was a lot of fun. And hopefully in the future, we'll do more of these if there is interest. In the meanwhile, please visit yieldstreet.com, www.yieldstreet.com for more information on new offerings. These go out in emails as well. And again, if you are an originator joining us and you're interested to learn about how you can join the platform to raise capital, please click on that raise capital link on our website in the footer, or send an email to originations@yieldstreet.com. And we're constantly releasing new content. We are strong believers in education and sharing all these interesting asset classes that we're exploring and our views on the economy in general. So please keep checking in on a regular basis. Stay safe, everyone, and stay healthy.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Yield. For the latest updates on the alternative investing space, go to yieldstreet.com. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. If you enjoyed the show, feel free to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, as this will help other investors like yourself find our show. If you have any questions, please visit us at yieldstreet.com. Thanks again for listening, and see you next week. The Yield Street podcast you just heard only reflects the opinions of the host, who is an associated person of Yield Street, and does not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street or any of its affiliates or other associates. The podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell any security, and is not an offer or sale of any securities or investment product. The podcast is also not a research report and is not intended to be and should not be construed as investment advice.
Support for this podcast comes from Yield Street. Trying to time the stock market can lead to regret. At Yield Street, our alternative investments are designed to create predictable secondary income streams, providing you with tools to help put your money to work immediately. These investments in asset classes like art, real estate, and legal finance typically have low correlation with the stock market and target annual yields up to 7-10%. Welcome to the next generation of investing. Welcome to Yield Street. Sign up today at yieldstreet.com.